Welcome to IFG FYI, the official podcast of Idaho Forest Group. We're here to talk about forests, lumber, sustainability, and the people behind it all. Whether you're in the industry or just curious about how wood gets from the forest to the frame, we've got stories, insights, and sometimes a few laughs along the way. So let's dive in. Welcome, everyone, to Idaho Forest Group's first official podcast. We're excited to speak with our very first guest, Blake Manley. He is both a seasoned logger and a teacher, and he's helping to train our next generation of forestry professionals. And we're going to talk today about the importance of responsible forest management and workforce development to conserve our future. So, this is a crucial topic, as many people in the industry know, and so we are going to pick Blake's brain on how we can solve these issues. So, Blake, welcome. Thank you for giving us your time.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for having me. Exciting times.
Yeah. Well, tell us first a little bit about your background.
Yeah, so my dad's logger. My grandpa was logger. I'm a fourth-generation logger. I started in the woods in 99 as a knot bumper and pulling rigging off of a D5 cat and jobs that don't exist anymore, which is crazy to think that I'm old enough to have jobs that don't exist in right. The industry I grew up in. So I did that for a few years, got my degree, worked for a couple different mills in different capacities, one as a log buyer, one as a night shift mill supervisor, and then went back home. Got married, went to the family business. From there, I was always but working with our youth, coaching, officiating, doing something with our youth. And so when an opportunity came up in 2018 to start a forestry program at Sweet Home High School in Western Oregon, I grabbed onto it. I latched on. I was very excited. Built that program from about 50 kids that wanted to be there. They shoved others into the program, but about 50 that wanted to be there to, you know, the last year I was there, there was over 500 that had signed up for the 240 seats we were offered. So it was very successful tying in that forestry component into our public school system. Moved back over here to the great state of Idaho, where my family's extremely happy to live here. Started working at the University of Idaho, worked there for about 18 months doing workforce development. Wasn't the perfect connection, and so I've kind of stepped out on my own now, and I do workforce development for the whole forest product sector in the state of Idaho. So that's how I got to where I'm at today.
Jeez. Well, and it's obvious how passionate you are about this, and that definitely stems from, obviously, a long family history and your own personal history in the industry. And so you see firsthand, boots on the ground, not only where the industry's been, where it is now, and where it needs to go. So that's why we feel like it's really important to talk to you about all this. So I guess maybe one of the first questions is, why do you think career development is so important in the forest products industry? I know when I grew up in a rural area and a lot of kids had loggers as dads, but we had no such curriculum. And maybe that shows X amount of years later.
It does. It absolutely does. Mine, same way. You know, my buddies, I grew up in Northeast Oregon, a very vibrant forestry area. And, you know, I have a few friends that got into forestry, but there was no classes. There was no exposure. If your dad didn't take you to the woods, you didn't go to the woods. And we see that effect now, you know, because for the 25-30 year period from the late 80s through the, you know, 10 years ago, or even some would say even today, there was a lot of negative publicity about the forestry industry. So if you didn't see if you didn't literally see the positive, you weren't looking to go do that career. You know, it's not like a firefighter, you know, even if your dad's not a firefighter, everyone sees the positive, whether it's wildland or houses or anything like, they see the, oh man, a firefighter, they're good people. I want to do that when I, and we just, we crapped on the forestry sector as a society for so many years that those fringe kids, people, they just never even considered our path.
Yeah.
Other paths, you know, like the agriculture education and what FFA's done, they made it look fun. And it is fun, right? But They were in the classrooms. They were teaching about the positives. And then, you know, those fringe kids were like, hey, maybe I do want to do that. Mm-hmm. The construction industry, you know, maybe I do want to do that because nobody was killing it. Whereas our industry, you know, they killed it for so many years. So now, you know, retrospect, but now is the most important time, I think, ever for forest education, because we want to do all these things in the woods, but it takes all this effort and exposure to do it. And we've killed all that effort and exposure to where now everyone's trying to line the stars back up. There's no curriculum. Like you said, when we were growing up, I'll put you in my same age class. Let's pretend like we're somewhere between 30 and 60, right? Well, we'll just say that.
Safe. That is a fair guess.
Right? But that age gap, I mean, I'll go with that. That age gap, there was very little forest education being done in our schools. Some specific schools had it, very little. And we see that now in, we don't have people in the pipeline. Mm-hmm. You know, average age of a logger in the West is between 52 and 57 years old. Average age of a logging owner is over 60. You know, when you walk in most manufacturing plants across the West, forest manufacturing plants, you see mostly audiences that are 35 years and older. Mm-hmm. Again, because there was that lack of exposure. So we feel it's like a massive, huge portion to expose kids, exposure, exposure, exposure. Once we've done some exposure, which can start fourth grade all the way to ninth grade, you know, career exploration, exposure, however you want to look at that, there has to be a connecting dot to when they turn 18 and can go into the workforce. And I think that's where that forest education, not just exposure, but actually educating them, comes in. And that's a component we're also working on right now.
Yeah, because I'm sitting here at a desk. I have a desk job, but not everybody's built for that. So, you know, some of those kids, they're going to be hard workers. They're smart kids, but they might not see college as a track for them. And there's perfectly good ways to build a career and build a life and raise a family. They, like to your point, just need that exposure and an understanding on how to build that career path. And that's where you come in for sure.
Yeah, between 65 and 72% of rural Idaho kids are not going to a traditional four-year or two-year university, college or university, and we just don't do a great job of showing them all the opportunities that are out there. So what ends up happening for us is they go into the opportunities that they do see, mm-hmm. which is, you know, a construction or a lineman, you know, doing power poles. Important jobs, not taking anything away from that. But if we're not in that conversation, then those kids that are highly motivated, are good kids, do have good skill sets, go somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And then we're left with what's left over, which sometimes that's nothing. There isn't anything. So it's vital. Huge.
Yeah. Now, what do you see as, I mean, you kind of touched on it earlier, but the big misconceptions with this industry, that maybe it's different than it was 25 years ago, where maybe there was clear cutting and things happening to the environment that were not as palatable for the larger population. So how have those perceptions shifted, or how do we need to help form those conversations to shift them to where we are today?
I think it's three, as far as the workforce, there's three misconceptions. One is that we're just a bunch of Neanderthals that just go out in the woods and we cut down trees and we put them on trucks and we take them to the mill and there's no thought that goes into it.
Right.
There's
willy-nilly.
Yeah, we're just, hey, that's a sale, so done, right? Okay, that's so far from the truth that it's not even close. I use the saying often, and I wear it like a badge, as does a lot of the people in the industry, just a dumb logger. Right. a lot of people, oh, just a dumb logger, right? There is so much that goes into it today, and that's a good thing compared to when my dad broke into the industry in 72, when he turned 18 and graduated from high school. You know, the forest practices laws, most of them have come into place after that date in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, California, that are good for our streams, are good for the environment, are good for all those different components of environmental type advocacy or work, right? And mm-hmm. the loggers the foresters, the mill owners, they all know that and they appreciate that. So I think that's a huge misconception. We're not just a bunch of dumb loggers, foresters, forest products workers. The second one is that it's dangerous. It's the most dangerous job in the world. Well, okay, there's data that backs up that logging specifically is more dangerous than other occupations, but it is so significantly safer than it's ever been that all the trajectories of injuries and stuff are doing this. Mm-hmm. They're all going down. There's not one safety point that is doing this or staying here. They're all going down. We have less people in the brush. It's less physical than it's ever been. There's less timber fallers. Most people are in a cab, or they are in a piece of machinery, or they are in a safer environment than we've ever been. So that misconception is still very much out there of how dangerous and everyone, you're going to die. And my grandpa in 1964, yeah, that's a long time ago.
Yeah.
It's a lot safer. And the third one is more in the milling side, more in maybe what you deal with on a day-to-day basis. But it's that there's all these physical hard jobs in the mill. There's no green chain. When I started at a mill, when I was becoming a supervisor and I was learning I was pulling chain.
Yeah.
That almost doesn't exist. I'm not going to say it doesn't exist, but it almost doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Your technology in a mill is just fascinating.
Oh, yeah. I had a meeting today and we were meeting with the director of IT and just listening to all the different programs, and IT is such a huge component of these mills because they are super technical. And that's what, I mean, I've been with IFG for a year, I'm rounding up quite a bit, but not only on the conservation side, but the technical side, that's what blew me away. They're extremely conservation focused and safety focused and way more technical than I would have guessed. Yep. I mean, they rattled off, I don't even know how many programs that the organization uses, but these are perceptions people don't necessarily have, I guess is my point.
Yep. And I think that's why like Marie Price, who works with you,
yep,
and I are working on how many young people are we exposing to the industry in some capacity? How many are we doing right now? And how can we improve that? You know, with tours, with educational programs, with curriculums, with the, we're working on a CTE, career technical education pathway for forest products. We're trying to do all these things because the disconnect from common person to the industry has never been wider. While all the rest of those things are better, that one, I think, is wider.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is all great work. All right. So we're going to kind of move on. We've been talking on career development. We're going to talk about responsible forest management. And that, you know, kind of plays in hugely to the conservation focus that everybody has, that, like you said, loggers, people might not think that that is part of the gig, but it for sure is. So how do you explain kind of the idea of sustainable forestry to students or the general public? And
well, I can tell you how I did it to my students when I was teaching. I think that would be the easiest way. For some landowners, it's a crop. It's a straight up crop that they use. But like with a farm field, those farmers never abuse that crop. They never abuse that land. They don't, because they're going to use it for generations.
That's a good point.
And so in our industry, for those that treat it that way, in our industry, you know, in Oregon, they plant 4 trees for one that they cut down. In Idaho, I've heard certain landowners, it's up to 7 trees for every one that they cut down. Now, that's a lot of reforestation. That's a lot of work on the landscape. Not only that, but then the other point that I try to make to people is that every landowner and every place has a different prescription. I was just up in Northwest Montana this week, and we were looking at different landowners from site to site, how different they were, but it was because the topography was different. It was because the aspect, it was, you know, the soils were different. And I think today, we know more about our land than we ever have before, to where we treat each piece of land differently with how it needs to be done for that reforestation for the future, so that we have those important metrics, so that our future forests are in fact that future forests.
Yeah.
If we do nothing, we're seeing that result too in catastrophic fire. I mean, we're burning more acreage up to over 7 million acres per year in the United States as an average. We're not clear cutting 7 million acres in the national forest or anything like that in logging, but we're destroying it in other ways. So
yeah.
I think there's a balance there to the whole equation.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it just makes sense. It's like weeding your garden. You know, you have to care for this area. You have to get out the bad. You don't want this invasive, you know, pest infestations and just dead wood. It's cultivating your garden. So,
yeah.
So do you have any specific, you gave specific examples about kind of what you just saw, but any specific projects maybe that have shown to, I know that there's a lot of technology going back to that discussion, you know, drones and Geiger LiDAR, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, I never know, but just really honing in on managing forests that way through technology.
Yeah, LiDAR is a fascinating thing. In fact, mm-hmm. that's a whole podcast by itself.
Yeah. All right. We'll do that quarterly.
right. But LiDAR, for those who don't know what LiDAR is a sensor is attached to a plane. In the instances that I've worked with the most, on a plane, they fly over a place, they shoot down the sensors, and they actually measure the trees and measure the growth because they'll shoot it several times. And that's very rudimentary explanation. But for those that have no idea what it is, you know, that's what it is. So the great part about a lot of land ownerships that are using LiDAR is they can literally exactly within very small margins of error tell what their forest is doing. How fast is it growing? Whereas before, when I was going up through the ranks, you know, you'd go out and do a piece of ground and you'd cruise it. So you'd measure it with a measuring tape, measure the height. You do plots. And so it's a certain percentage of a whole, you know, land ownership extrapolated out. Well, this is literally flying over and hitting almost all of your trees. And then the actual growth that's happening. And then a lot of land ownerships are saying, okay, we're growing, you know, 2 billion board feet a year on our property. All right, we can cut 1.8 billion board feet. That's maybe a too big of an example, but realistically, right, we can do that because we know how much is growing. That's fascinating technology. The other project I think that needs more national publicity than anyone else is the A to Z project on the Colville National Forest.
Yes, I've seen, they do a great promotional video on that. Yep.
Yeah.
I'll share that at the end of this for folks who want to take a peek at it.
Yeah, should because it's 124 million board feet cut last year. It's the number mm-hmm. one producing national forest in the United States. And they're using those funds for all kinds of amazing projects right there at home, where then the taxpayer isn't having to pay for it. It's coming out of very sustainable forest management right there at home. It's fascinating. Please look at that video and what they're doing.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Let's see. What other questions do I have here? What do you see as the biggest opportunities for improvement? This is a loaded question in forest stewardship over the next decade.
National forests.
Yeah. Yeah.
You want
to speak to that, the opinions or thoughts on the executive order and where that might go?
Yeah, so that is a loaded question. Thanks.
I know.
You're in government
affairs.
I'm
going to put it on you too. For folks who don't know, I guess I can dumb it. I'm very good at dumbing things down. that's the only level I speak. But so the current administration issued an executive order. I don't know if it's been a month ago.
March 1st.
See, you know the details. I will do the dumbing down overarching, but. Proposing that public lands be opened up for harvesting and development. That's very much dumbing it down, but
yep.
You can take it from there.
Yeah, no, that dummies it down. There's a couple of misconceptions about that executive order.
Yep.
One is they've used a couple different figures I've seen, but it's several million, tens of millions of acres that they want to open up. the misconception that's out there is that is opened up to literally clear cut from one place to the other and just mow everything down in that whole area. And that is 100% not what the executive order is about. It's about thinning the forest, thinning the threat. Most of what that executive order wants to do is there's 60 plus million acres across the West that have been scientifically proven to be at an elevated, a high to very high risk of catastrophic wildfire. And the ADZ project's a great place to start for those that don't know anything about that, but they don't clear cut a whole millions of acres on that forest every year. There's a lot of selected harvest going on where they mark or they have a prescription where they're leaving a lot of trees, but they're taking out the dead, the dying. Maybe they're taking out overcrowded, and they're making those communities a lot more fire safe. If we've learned nothing else over the last 15 to 20 years, it's that Northern California has a lot of communities that are in high, high fire danger areas. Most of those communities surrounded by national forest. And we just shut the national forest down for so many years that it's now grown. And another piece of that is that, you know, since the 1910 fires, 110, 115 years ago, we fought fire like it was a war, putting out every single one. While we were harvesting, that wasn't a horrible thing. But then when we're cutting out all fire, which was burning up all the little trees and some of that debris, we cut the fire out and then we cut the harvesting out. Now we've got a situation where we've grown up all that foliage and all that fuel. We need to reduce that threat back down to, you know, more historic pre-1910 levels. That is what that executive order is number one focused on. It's not on profitability and clear cutting and all these billionaires that are going to become multi-trillionaires because now we're going to let them cut down every stick of our national forest. That's not what it's about.
Yeah, no, it presents itself to be something very positive. I mean, it's going to be a long-term thing, but circling back to the importance of career development and workforce development, you know, if this goes as planned, you're going to need a whole lot of boots on the ground to execute it. So
Yeah, absolutely. That's my number one concern with the executive order. It's not some of that noise that I was talking about. It's that if we do have the go-ahead to harvest it, if milling capacity can handle it across the West, there's certain player or places that if that's not a problem. Milling capacity, we have it. If those things line up, if there's a market to then send this material to, some ifs, but if that all kind of coincides, who's going to do the work? And that's where the workforce development, that's where that exposure, that's where all those pieces of the puzzle are so important.
So what is your day? This isn't part of my loaded questions, but what is your day like? I mean, or week even? How many kids are you, schools are you reaching out to? I know I'm going, I don't know if you're going to sawmills and schools in Orofino on the 22nd, but I'm going to that. I'll look forward to seeing that. So I guess maybe speak a little about that.
So our goal, I have a partnership with several people around the state of Idaho and the region, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Western Montana. And kind of our goal is that I'll be in 30-ish schools per year in some capacity. This year, that looked a lot different because I worked for the University of Idaho for a while and we did that. They're doing great things within the state of Idaho for workforce development as well. Oregon has the Future Natural Resource Leaders, very good things in the realm of high school education for forestry. There are great things happening. The goals are more. Like of everybody that I'm working with, it's just flat out more. IFG has a great program for millwrights and training millwrights. You've invested a lot of money in that program, but you've also invested it in the people. And it shows. You know, I hate to say it, but we were sitting in a millwright shop and one of the guys said, he's like, I hate to say it, but you know, the last couple of guys that have come in here came from logging crews because they wanted something different. They wanted a different look. You know, maybe it was the hours, maybe whatever it was for them, family changed, location of where they live changed. And so they're taking guys out of the woods. But then in the same sense, he says, we still need more guys in the woods. So that's where that exposure comes about. There's great things happening, but we have to, 30 schools, that's a minimum goal.
Right.
30 schools. There's now 8 sawmills at high schools in the state of Idaho. 5 years ago, there were none. Right. So now you have that learning opportunity that's coming about. The curriculum that's coming, the pathway in forest products that we're meeting on this month, that's coming in one shape or the other to expose kids to that. So, and I'm part of all those things. I don't do all of those things, but I'm part of all those things.
Yeah.
And my goal is that there's certain things happening that maybe we get started and then I go do something else. You know, we get started and I'm doing something else, and other players, other people can kind of take those over.
So what do you think businesses like IFG support, things that you do, but how can people help support the work you do? People, just regular people off the street, companies, you know, how and where can someone go to help build up this work? Because it is so important.
Two very important things. One is do it on your own. And that's very hard. And I understand that. Superintendent Debbie Critchfield and I have had this conversation many times, the superintendent of public instruction for the state of Idaho. Mm-hmm. She says very eloquently, much better speaker than I am. she says that schools tend to fix problems inside the walls. They're always looking to fix those problems inside the walls. And industries on the outside of the walls, waiting for them to open the door. Lots of times the schools won't open the door, and it's not because they don't want to, it's because they're fixing problems inside the walls, right? So I encourage the regular Joe, Jane, Jill, and John, right?
All the J's.
All right. I encourage them to knock on that door, open that door, make that attempt, even if it's a little uncomfortable, because the school does want you there. In 75 to 80% of our schools across the state of Idaho, across the region, they do want you there, but they are constantly doing this on the inside. So number one is get involved in some capacity. The second is this work takes a lot of work to do. Yeah. There's several people that are doing it, and we all find the same thing out regionally. The Associated Logging Contractors, IFG, has already donated a very generous donation to the Association of Loggers in Idaho. There's a workforce development fund that they have, and IFG has made the first donation to that fund. And that funds the ability to go to those schools, that it funds the ability to work on that curriculum, make videos. It funds the ability to, you know, work with the state of Idaho Department of Education, to be able to be a voice in those conversations. And I think my voice is fairly unique. I'll just say that compared to other people that might, because I did log, I did work for a mill, and I was a high school teacher, and I worked for 18 months for a university. So I've kind of seen a spectrum of things that's different than other people.
Yeah. A unicorn, if you will.
Yeah. I definitely got the horn, right? Yeah. I mean, that fund. So if you can't physically, and there is a lot of people out there that can, if you can't physically get involved yourself, but you want to be involved, that fund is one way to be involved. And the association has a whole board that oversees that fund so that it is spent within the interests of the forest products industry for the state of Idaho.
That's good to know. I will share all of this information as well. I'm assuming that's a link on their website.
I can get you that link. Yep.
Easy. Also, probably a noteworthy shout out is the Idaho Forest Products Commission. They have a lot of information, a lot of educational resources, a lot of conservation educational resources that might change people's perception. So I'll share that as well.
They also have a really awesome busing program too, for, and I don't remember what the exact amount is. Please research that out, but it's $200-$300, something like that, to pay for busing to be able to take kids on field trips. And that's a great program to just get. I know that's a limiting factor for a lot of our schools.
Oh yeah. Is
just be able to pay for the bus. And so that's a great program. That was absolutely great mention.
Yeah. Well, I can't, unless you can think of anything else, Blake, I think that might be a wrap today. You do important work, and I'm so honored that you spent some time with us talking on our very first podcast. So the bar, so for anyone listening to this or watching this, the bar was set low. It's just going to get better from here, but we hope to bring Blake back and maybe a student or two to talk about their experience too, or someone young in the industry who can kind of help give some testimonials on this message. But so for our listeners, if you're interested in learning more about what we talked about, I will share some information on the screen. And thanks for everyone who tuned in. Don't forget to subscribe to the Idaho Forest Group podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and we'll try to, if you have any ideas, I'll also have an email where people can share their ideas on content they'd like to learn more about.